Time now for our Ask an Expert segment. Each weekday at this time on KCBS, we're giving you direct access to top experts in various fields related to the pandemic. Today, let's begin with a focus on how our year of disinfecting and hand sanitizing and cleaning everything we can get to may have affected our personal microbiomes. To answer your questions, I'm joined live on the KCBS Ring Central Newsline by Dr. Brett Finley, professor at the University of British Columbia. Dr. Finley, good morning. How are you?
Good morning, Stan. I'm fine.
So, you know, this is a topic you and I had a chance to discuss briefly in an interview a few days ago, but there is emerging understanding about our little friends inside, our personal microbiome. Do you feel things may have been knocked out of whack or potentially so by the way we've lived this last year?
Yeah, so I'm a microbiologist and that's how I see the world. And, you know, when I look at another person, I see this really vessel that is actually have as many microbes in and on them as they have human cells. And just because you can't see these critters, they're actually all over you, mainly on the outside of the body, especially in the gastrointestinal tract. And we know they're there, but only in the last decade or so have we realized they really do much for us. And it turns out they actually do very a lot for us, especially early in life. They help our immune system develop and our brain development and various other parts of the body actually develop. And then even in normal life, you know, we know things such as obesity and asthma and diabetes are now all related to imbalance in these microbes. So for the last, 125 years or so, we've been on a crusade to get rid of microbes because they cause disease. And that's worked very well when you look around society. We don't have the infectious disease they had a century ago. And so we thought, well, this is great. And then about a decade or so, we started to realize, oh, well, maybe we're taking out the good ones with the bad, and maybe we shouldn't be so hyper-hygienic about it all. And that's when we started to realize that our diets and the way we behave about kill all microbes is actually not good for us in some senses. And so then we went on a campaign that, well, maybe you should be nicer to your microbes and expose them more. And I even read wrote a book called Let Them Eat Dirt. It's how to raise your kids with their microbes. And then COVID hit, and then bam, we went back to 100 years ago. Avoid all bugs. Don't talk to anyone. You know, stay in your own home, and you know, don't expose. And so, what we know based on history is that when you deprive the body of these normal healthy microbes, especially at the bookends of life, early and late life, it has bad effects on us. And so, our concern is that as we've gone to this hygiene mode, which we had to do because that's the only way we could survive the pandemic, it's going to have unintended consequences down the line. And so, that's the message we're trying to get out, that, well, you know, an unintended consequence of all this living at home for a year is actually not good for your microbes.
So let's talk a little about specifics regarding microbes. I know there's been a lot of work around asthma in particular, and there are some results that make this pretty clear, right?
Yeah, very much so. So asthma is a lovely example. We've worked a lot on it. Well, not lovely if you have it. But so what we know is that the early life microbes are really important for helping your immune system develop. And if you're born by a cesarean section, which, you know, 25% of people are, you actually have about a 25 to 30% higher chance of becoming asthmatic. And even obesity, you've got about a 30% higher chance of becoming obese just by how you stick your head into the world. And we now know that's associated with the initial colonization of the microbes of the mother, fecal and vaginal microbes. And this actually then helps the immune system develop normally. And if you're deprived of that normal microbes, you then go towards allergic, asthmatic type immune system, which then makes you much more prone for asthma later in life. So if you imagine a child born during COVID, it's a very different world compared to pre-COVID, where, you know, you go to daycare and you're crawling around a bunch of other kids and the neighbor's kids and everything, as well as many different grandparents' microbes and stuff. Yet, you know, these days in COVID, you're whisked away and you basically live in isolation for a year. And that's the most formative time of a baby's life for getting the right microbes. So, yes, I think that, you know, we know with antibiotics and things, you increase asthma. I think with COVID, we're going to see an increase in asthma rates and obesity rates then probably about 5 years from now when these diseases actually kick in with the children that were born during COVID.
Let me get way out there with you, because I know you've been involved in a lot of interesting stuff, including working on the SARS vaccine almost 20 years ago. Is there any potential link, do you think, between these substandard microbiomes, let's call them, and the way people respond to something like COVID-19?
Yeah, so we and others have been looking at this, and it's a great idea. There are some infectious diseases that the microbes really do determine whether or not you're susceptible to them. thus far, there hasn't been any data in a specific sense, like you have a certain microbe, you're more susceptible. But even, you know, cofactors that increase your disease, like obesity, we know that that's related to the microbes, and that's a cofactor, a higher chance of getting COVID, for example. And the other thing they do is we just talked about the affect immune system, and it's certainly possible that people with aberrant microbiomes may have a different type of immune system and then be more or less susceptible to COVID. And so that's work ongoing. We don't have answers. I've not seen any stories or papers yet on this, but it's certainly a possibility. But we know it's true for other diseases in terms of how they shape the immune system.
Let me toss something out at you that's come up in some of the vaccine resistance, maybe a conflation of understanding, but you know this stuff, so you can straighten it out for us. If antibiotics kill those kinds of germs, bacteria, and a vaccine prevents a virus from doing its work, what's the difference? How do they work differently? Why should we fear one or use one less often and embrace the other?
Well, they're both very, very powerful medical tools. So antibiotics, anti means against, of course, and biotic means life. So technically that means against life. Antibiotics, you're really generally talking about antibacterials. So we're going to talk about two kinds of microbes, bacteria and viruses. And these are different, quite different microbes. Bacteria can multiply on their own, a petri dish usually, and viruses, they need a cell to live within, a human cell. So when you take an antibiotic, you're targeting a bacterial infection. These are things like Streptococcus pneumoniae that causes pneumonia, and chlamydia, and tuberculosis. These are all bacteria. So antibiotics generally target bacteria. If it's targeting a virus, that's what we call antivirals. Now, vaccines, what they do is they tickle the immune system to respond to an infectious agent. It could be a bacterium. It could be a virus. So when you get vaccinated, for example, there's something called DPT, that's diphtheria, pertussis, and tetanus. Those are bacteria. Yet the flu vaccine, the flu, is a virus. So vaccines are a way of stimulating the immune system. It's a natural response, but instead of seeing the flu virus itself, you're seeing a piece of the flu virus or a piece of the COVID virus. You're stimulating the immune system to say, oh, this is bad. I want the immune system to fight this off. So then when you actually go and get exposed to the real COVID, your immune system's already primed and ready to go and say, oh, this is bad. And so that's why you're basically boosting the immune system, the antibodies and the cellular responses to then kill off whatever this person is being vaccinated against. So they're very different critters. Antibiotics are used to treat infections and things. Vaccines are used to prevent diseases in the first place.
Good enough. I've taken notes, and next time somebody asks, I'll have a best explanation yet. Let's get to questions here, and reminding our audience that if anything comes to mind, please send that email off quickly to askus@kcbsradio.com. Our guest today, Dr. Brett Finlay, professor at the University of British Columbia. Let's start with this one. I always sanitize my hands now after I leave the grocery store, get gas, take an elevator, but is there a better alternative to using hand sanitizer when out and about? Is there an easy way to clean our hands just enough?
Yeah, generally speaking, soap and water, although viruses sometimes are harder to kill this way. I think, and presume you're talking mainly about COVID, which everyone is concerned about. So COVID is generally a respiratory, it's aerosol-borne, droplet-borne as well as just floating in the air. We know that. So the idea of surface transmission, it's if, say, a droplet lands on a counter and then you wipe your finger on that counter and then put it in your mouth, you could, in theory, get it. So we call this fomite transmission from surface. We actually see very little of that. It's generally speaking direct contact in close indoor spaces within 6 feet of each other, usually generally aerosolly transmitted between persons. So if you have an opera singer, you know, singing in your face, that's probably not good if they have COVID, for example. So that's why we've seen all this incredible encouragement of wearing of masks, because they really decrease the transmission of these droplets. So the hand sanitizer thing is, I guess, is if you're worried about, you know, viruses landed on your hand. And we do put our hands in our mouth a lot more than we ever think we do. We're always touching our faces and our noses and our mouth. And so there is some risk of that. So I would say during COVID for now, use hand sanitizer judiciously, for sure, like every time you've come out of contact with other people. But then as soon as I think COVID is done, we should really go back to soap and water, probably just before meals. And you don't need to use hand sanitizer in the playground when the child goes from the teeter-totter to the swing, for example, as I've seen parents do.
Yeah.
We need to tone that down. So that's the whole hygiene versus microbial exposure balance we've got to struggle with.
You know, it's funny. I'm just thinking back as you were answering that to very early in the pandemic, we talked to somebody who I believe was a promoter of World Hand Washing Day. And it became clear that what really happens when you use soap and water, the soap, more or less, it's friction and the ability to sort of break down the outer shell of the virus that's doing the good. It doesn't actually kill the virus per se. Do I remember that correctly?
Yeah, well, soap is basically a detergent. What detergents do, they dissolve things such as fats and lipids, which the outside of bacteria and viruses are made. So the other detriment of using soap is we know that excessive hand hygiene actually leads to more skin infections and things, because you actually have a lot of microbes living on your hands, and these things are normally there, and they prevent the bad ones when they land from taking hold. And so when you get rid of all the microbes on your hand, you actually increase your skin infections. Because we did not evolve. Cavemen were not taking showers three times a day and washing their hands. That's not how we evolved. And so having microbes on us is, you know, and you can even tell the difference when you're right and your left hand. They have different microbes because they're touching different things when you think of what you do in your day-to-day activities. And so skin microbes are normal. I think hand sanitizer during COVID as needed. But again, this is not something that I think that we should be embracing thoroughly all the time at all times. We're just getting too hyper-hygiene. And pre-COVID, really, it was just soap and water before dinner kind of thing, and that was it.
Okay. Next one. What's the best way to build up your, quote, good bacteria after a year of disinfecting? Should we be going back to things like shaking hands with people we meet?
That's a terrific question. Like, how do we fix them?
Right.
And we've even encountered this, like if you take antibiotics for, say, an infection, especially women, you suddenly get urinary tract infections because you wiped out the antibiotics. Mm-hmm. They carpet bomb your microbes everywhere, and so your normal microbes in the vagina, which are normally protective, are no longer there, and so that's why women see, say, urinary tract infections or diarrhea post-antibiotics. So this is a great question. We're still all struggling with it. I think for example, you know, our diets have changed during the pandemic, and many people have, you know, gone to, I don't know, takeout or cooking at home or working their way through a bread book. Diet is a really good way of improving your microbes. So that's the usual, you know, say Mediterranean, you know, less white sugar, white flour, and lots more fruits, nuts, vegetables, fish, olive oil kind of things. That really promotes a good microbe. There are no good probiotics that you can really take that are necessarily going to do it, because most probiotics don't actually stick and colonize. Fermented foods are one way of acquiring microbes. I think rolling in the grass, letting the dog slobber on you, these are great ways with kids being exposed. Get outside. You don't have to be hugging a person. But I think the whole person-to-person transmission is an interesting one. Like every time you kiss a person, you transmit 80 million microbes. So I don't know what the French are doing.
Probably shut down the whole operation there, especially some regions where you go in three times, right, left, right.
Yeah, well, yeah. I actually tried to look up studies about French kissing and other things and, you know, what the difference is in and Eskimo nose rubbing and things, but I couldn't find any. But I think, you know, post-pandemic, I mean, I must admit, even I find myself behaving differently when I come up to a stranger. I mean, you don't just, you know, hug a stranger anymore, and I'll be curious to see where handshaking goes in the future, you know, because now we're just elbow bumping and fist pumping.
Well, okay, but medically speaking, right? I mean, if I saw you right there on the campus in Vancouver, would we shake hands?
Post-COVID, I'm going to. Absolutely.
I may
even give you a hug because I think it's important. I think that, you know, you need to get these. I mean, think of it as sort of like, you know, the Amazon rainforest. You want a diverse ecosystem. You want as many different kind of microbes as you can get in there, because that actually makes you healthier. We know diversity is really important. And so, you know, if you say, had severe diarrhea, your microbes are really hurting, you know, diet and eating variety of foods and, you know, trying to select for good microbes and things, and, you know, transmission. Now, there is a double-edged sword to that, because actually we know a lot of these infectious, non-infectious diseases like obesity and diabetes, there is significant evidence that they may actually be there. We know that microbes are playing a big role, and maybe, you know, transmitting with someone that has bad microbes could, in theory, transmit them to you. Like if you have an obese friend, you have a 40% higher chance of becoming obese yourself. Is it because they're microbes, or you just share the same diets? There's a lot of arguments about that. So I don't know, but I think we have to think how we evolved, and we evolved as tribes living together, living this sea of feces in the soil and sleeping in the dirt, and that's just normal for Homo sapiens. And so I think the idea of, you know, living in these sanitized bubbles that we're doing now is not how we evolved. And I worry that we're hurting the microbes that we've evolved with and actually taking them out of the equation. And, you know, decades from now, we might realize, oh, no, we really did get rid of a bug that was actually good for us without knowing it, kind of thing.
This next question wants to know, are there products that would kill viruses but not potentially good bacteria?
Yeah, that's a hard one. I mean, there are certain antivirals, not for COVID, but for flu. You know, you heard things of Tamiflu and stuff. These specifically target certain viruses. But generally speaking, they're quite different critters. And antibiotics are very general. They're antibacterials, we've said, and they basically kill a ton of different kinds of microbes. Antivirals are usually much more specific for targeting a specific virus. And so you take it for a particular viral disease, and so they're different. But the answer is no in that sense, to kill off viruses and not bacteria. And okay. There's really no good anti-COVID antivirals that are out there yet.
Yeah, that's another whole story, right? This next one, I mean, if you wouldn't mind tackling a couple maybe around vaccines, because people have a lot of interest, and I know you have some background. What are the differences between various antibody tests? If I want to do an antibody test after a vaccine to show I have the antibodies, as required for some travel, et cetera, or even that I had the infection, does it matter which test I do? Does the test have to be tailored to which vaccine I got or whether I actually had the infection?
Yeah, I got 3 hours.
Yeah, I know. That's a lot.
Yeah, so the reason they're doing antibody testing, as we discussed, you know, when you get vaccinated, you're tickling the immune system, so you will then produce antibodies to the virus. So when you actually do hit the real virus, you have what are called neutralizing antibodies that bind to the outside of the virus and then wash it away, and so you don't get infection. So that's why, in theory, having a good antibody level to the COVID virus is generally protective, because you coat this virus with these antibodies when you see it, and it doesn't actually establish and cause infection. Now, different tests are different, and I don't think we should get into the details of each of them, because I don't know enough of, you know, the pros and cons and everything. Generally speaking, there's two things you can test for. One is the antibodies, so have you mounted an immune response. That's not perfectly predictive of whether it's going to protect you or not. Generally speaking, it is, but you know, some people have antibodies, but they're not neutralizing antibodies, so they don't get as much protection. And then, of course, there's the antiviral tests themselves, where they're actually using DNA amplification technologies to see, is the virus there at all? And that's when you go for your COVID test. That's what they're doing there. They're saying, is there any viral nucleic acid that we can detect in you, so you actually have the virus or not floating around in you?
Okay. This next one says, fascinating conversation. We're all learning more and more about beneficial bacteria. Is there such a thing as a beneficial virus?
These are great questions.
we got them.
You know, so the way the world has worked is that we've gotten very good at characterizing the bacteria in our gut, because they have a common genetic sequence. We can just put in these generic primers and sequence off of that and say who's there, so we don't have to grow them. The problem is each virus is different. So the only way you can figure out what virus is there is do this massive sequencing effort and try and find viral sequences, but you don't know which belongs to which. So we actually know very little about viruses and whether they're that are even there. We've learned a lot about bacteria and the fungi, but not the viruses. So that is an area in its infancy of research. It requires huge amounts of sequence and bioinformatic power to actually try and figure out if there's virus sequences there. There are a lot of viruses in us. I mean, the human genome is full of proviral sequences that are just hanging out in our genetics. We picked them up over the thousands of years. And also, there's a lot of bacterial viruses. So these viruses attack the bacteria, not humans. These are called phages and bacteriophages, and there's about 100 of those for every bacteria in the gut. So you think there's a lot of bacteria, there's phenomenal viruses. But really right now, we don't really know much about good and bad viruses and whether they're good for us or not. So great question, lousy answer.
Well, I'll let you get off easy with this last one then, and it's one we hear quite often. Got my second Pfizer dose on April 5th. Other than a sore arm, no side effects. 3 weeks later, I came down with fever, chills, body aches, muscle weakness, and headache. Could this be a delayed response to the vaccine? I did test negative for COVID-19.
Very, very unlikely. I mean, Pfizer's vaccine is a wonderful vaccine. It's been in millions and millions of people, and then the side effects and the adverse effects have been... I mean, this is actually a real tribute to technology, because we didn't have mRNA virus technology before COVID. It's going to change the whole vaccine game, but they're incredibly safe and incredibly effective so far. And 3 weeks out, it's when you get vaccinated, just an infinitesimal amount of this viral RNA goes into you. So it's not like you're getting this big bolus that's going to hang around your body for weeks you react to. So the immune system is really, really good at smelling out these tiny, tiny amounts and then developing responses. It's unlikely. Proving this, yes or no, unless you want to lock up a whole bunch of people and then just wait 3 weeks for everyone. But the adverse effects 3 weeks out of the second dose are really not correlated. And the fact you got a sore arm, that's probably good. That means it's doing what it's supposed to do. It's pissing off your immune system, and then you're going to react to it. So sore arm, that's very normal. They do follow all the adverse events of all these vaccines very closely, and I'm sure you all heard about the AstraZeneca issues and things that are much bigger than the mRNA vaccines.
Yeah.
So I think it's unlikely, but again, definitively proving it is very difficult.
Sounds like one of your other little germ friends who was involved here then.
I think so. Yeah, or bacteria. They're even more friends.
All right. Well, with a hearty virtual handshake then, I bid you adieu. Thanks for the time this morning.
Okay, here's a fist bump, and thanks a lot.
All right, take care. Bye-bye. Dr. Brett Findlay is a professor at the University of British Columbia. And that wraps up Ask an Expert for this morning.